are some numbers that might surprise you. In 2020, 349 people were killed in airplane crashes in the United States, although not a single one of those involved a commercial airline. So maybe you can breathe easier the next time you jump on a flight with a U.S. carrier. On the other hand, more than 6,700 Americans died that same year just walking or using wheelchairs to get where they were going. And last year, that number jumped 11.5% to nearly 7,500 pedestrians killed by cars. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We usually refer to these crashes as accidents, but that word would imply the suffering is randomly distributed wherever people on foot and people in automobiles share the same spaces. What my guest has found instead is a pattern of hotspots where it is especially deadly for walkers to get around, and the way these spaces are designed seems to play a major role. Maren Kogan wrote about this for Vox, where she's a senior correspondent. Her article is called The Deadliest Road in America. Maren, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
The United States is experiencing what you call a pedestrian fatality crisis. It's obviously tragic when anybody is killed this way, but the rate at which the numbers have been rising in recent years is truly alarming. Is it unprecedented?
It is alarming. It is an unprecedented rise in pedestrian fatalities. So pedestrian fatalities have been on the rise in this country for the last decade, but the numbers really started accelerating in a way that was very alarming to experts, basically at the beginning of the pandemic. So, in 2020, there were 6,700 pedestrians killed walking on foot in this country. And then in 2021, it got even worse. There were 7,400 pedestrians killed by drivers. And that is the most in 40 years. So those numbers are extremely alarming. And they point to something going on in this country. We haven't seen these levels of pedestrian fatalities rise in other countries. So experts are really looking at and trying to figure out what is going on in the U.S. and why are these numbers going up here?
Yeah, I mean, that's the first big question, right, is why is this happening now in particular?
It's a great question, and there are lots of different possible answers. So certainly, when pedestrian fatalities started going up, a lot of people said, well, it's just reckless driving and people are, sort of losing touch a little bit because of the pandemic. And I think anecdotally, I think we've all noticed some changes in our communities. I don't know if you've noticed this in your community, but certainly, the reason that I got into this story was just noticing in my own neighborhood. My home office overlooks a four-way intersection, and I saw so many cars just, driving at high speeds through the intersection, and in many cases, not even stopping. So I think there are a couple different things going on here. One is that the pandemic disrupted our normal traffic patterns, and a lot of experts think that that actually is in large part to blame for the rise in pedestrian fatalities. One of the best traffic calming measures we have in this country is congestion, which people are always surprised to hear because we think of congestion as a very annoying and frustrating thing. But actually, congestion is often keeping people from driving at really high speeds and driving in unsafe ways. And so when you remove those usual traffic patterns of congestion, it opened the roads up. And unfortunately, the roads are designed in ways that, encourage high-speed travel, particularly roads, which I'm sure we'll talk about here in a little bit. But that disruption opened the roads up and allowed drivers to drive a lot more dangerously. The other element of this that I think is at play is that in the last 10 to 20 years, large trucks and SUVs have become a much bigger share of the commercial vehicle market. And those vehicles are much deadlier to pedestrians than smaller sedans and smaller SUVs and smaller cars.
Are there ways that cars could be redesigned so that, God forbid you hit a pedestrian, but that person is somewhat protected?
Absolutely. So the biggest thing is that we could start making smaller cars. the United States, our cars are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I know you see a lot of this in Texas and you see a lot of it in my community in Washington, D.C. as well. But the cars have gotten a lot bigger. And the reasons for that is that, they're comfortable. They're very safe for the people who are inside the cars. And they have a lot of features that are really attractive to drivers. But the flip side of that is that they tend to be a lot less safe for people outside of the vehicles. So we could make cars smaller again. We could start making cars smaller. And there are also safety features that cars could install. That would make them safer for people outside of vehicles. You know, right now the government is not even looking at the safety of a vehicle for people outside of cars. They'll test it for safety of people inside of cars, but not outside of cars. So there's been a big push this year to get the government to start studying a car safety rating, not just for the people inside the car, but for the people outside of it as well.
Broadly speaking, we think of folks in Europe as driving smaller cars on average than we do. And it's really interesting that although people in Europe seem to walk a lot more places than typical Americans, their rates of pedestrian fatalities are much lower, right?
That's absolutely right. And it's for a couple of different reasons. I think the car thing that you mentioned is absolutely a part of them. A lot of the cars that we sell here are not even available on the market in Europe because they're too big. So that's a big part of it. I think another part of it is that there's a much more ingrained sense of pedestrian culture, and in part because the cities are in many cases ancient. They were designed at a time when people were not using automobiles. In the United States, we had a lot of growth in this country post-automobile, and part of what that has done is created an infrastructure that is sort of car primary and treats pedestrians and cyclists as secondary. And that's sort of what I'm trying to get into in the piece, is that we have a lot of design issues. It's not necessarily about blaming people. You know, particularly in the case of some of the roads that I wrote about, people are doing what is rational. If the road is built for you to go at a high speed, you're going to do that. It's going to make sense for you to do that. And if the road is so unfriendly to pedestrians that it means walking miles to make it to an intersection, people are going to run across the street. So we've ended up creating, sort of by design, a really deadly infrastructure system, particularly when it involves roads interacting with car or drivers interacting with cars. And in many parts of Europe, there's just sort of a different infrastructure and a different culture around needing to share the road.
My guest is Maren Kogan, who's a senior correspondent at Vox, where you can find her article, The Deadliest Road in America. You focus here, Maren, on US 19 in Florida. And listeners might be thinking, well, that is far away from where I live. I don't drive or walk along that road. I may never do so. But I gather the point of telling the story through the lens of this one road is that lots of conditions there exist in roads we do walk and bike and drive along, right?
Yes, that is such a good point. And, you know, I really wanted this story to be about a national crisis in pedestrian fatalities, because this isn't just Florida. This is happening all over the country. And I do think it's easy to look at this one road in Florida and say, well, you know, it's Florida. I mean, we all sort of think of Florida as a place that has a higher number of pedestrian fatalities. I think there's a lot of traffic and a lot of development there. But it is not just Florida. This story is based on a study by four researchers of all of the pedestrian fatality data the government has kept since 2001. And what they did is they tried to identify different hotspots around the country. These are 1,000-meter stretches of road where six or more people have been killed over an 8-year period. So they looked at all of the data and they identified 60 unique hotspots. Seven of those hotspots were on this one stretch of US 19 in Pasco County, Florida alone. But it wasn't just Florida. In fact, I went back and looked at the numbers before we got on this call, and there is one in Dallas. So I don't know if you want me to tell you where it is, but I looked this up.
Absolutely, I want you to tell me where it is.
Okay. So it's a stretch of South Riverfront Boulevard between Commerce Street and Jefferson Viaduct.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about that area, it doesn't surprise me, but I'm sad to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is. I mean, you know, I was surprised too, because the second deadliest hotspot in the country is in suburban Maryland, which is not far from where I'm from. So the study is really interesting, and it's a good way for people to look at where these hotspots are and in their communities. I mean, the interesting thing about this stretch of Riverfront Boulevard is that it looks like seven people were killed there between 2001 and 2008, and zero people were killed there between 2008 and 2016. So I don't know what that says exactly, because I haven't done all the research on this particular stretch of road, but it may be that, you know, the Texas Department of Transportation has made safety improvements that have decrease the fatalities. Now, it could also be the case that more people have died there since 2016. So it is interesting to go and look at these places in our own communities and to realize that it's not, unfortunately, it's not just a Florida problem. This is a national problem.
I want to go back to this term that you threw out a few minutes ago, which is strode. This is, I guess, just sort of a portmanteau of street and road. Why is that a factor in this?
Yeah. So strode is a term coined by a former traffic engineer named Charles Marone. He designed roads for a long time and ultimately has become sort of a critic of the way that we do that in this country. He says that a strode is a specific thing that we have in the United States, and you will probably see it in your own community. You'll probably see it, you know, if you're commuting today or driving somewhere today. So if you think of a road is meant to get people from point A to point B, right? So generally we think of like a freeway as a road, for example. So a freeway, you know, there's not a lot built up on either side, maybe some rest stops. All the traffic should be moving in one direction on your side. There's multiple lanes. It's high speed. Everyone's going the same direction. And there's lots of clear zones around the road, right? So if there is a driver error, God forbid, it's clear and they can sort of maybe drive off onto a grassy median and everyone will be okay. And there's not a lot of development on either side. Now, in contrast, a street is a place. So we all have these in our communities as well. They're places where people live, where they go out to eat, where they play, where they shop. And so you want a street to have much slower traffic so that drivers can't sort of whip through the area. They're forced to slow down and interact with the community. And you also want it to be safe for pedestrians, for the elderly, for people who need to get around more slowly. What Marone says is a strode is something that is trying to do both and is doing neither of them well. So you'll see these in your towns and cities. There are multiple lanes going either direction. They tend to be pretty high speed, or drivers move on them at very high speeds. There's also a lot of traffic. And then there's lots of commercial development on either side. So pedestrians are walking around and trying to navigate the space that fundamentally isn't built for them. And it just makes things infinitely more dangerous, both for the drivers and the pedestrians, because there are all these little intersections and turnoffs and places where that they have to come into contact potentially or conflict with pedestrians. It's very unsafe for them. And unfortunately, you know, this is something that we see in all sorts of communities. You know, it's a big feature of suburban sprawl. They are by design very, very unsafe for drivers too, but especially for pedestrians.
Well, and I think even in my own neighborhood, there are some places where you can, you know, press that button and you get the walk signal. But if you happen to walk slower than average, if you have a disability or you're pushing a stroller or whatever, you're hard pressed to get across that intersection before you're not supposed to be in it anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there are these places where it just feels like you're not supposed to be there as a pedestrian. I don't know if you've ever walked down a street where suddenly the sidewalk is just gone.
Right.
And there was no indication that that was coming. There are places where you just don't have enough time to cross the street. And on certain of these strodes, especially US 19 in Florida, where I visited, you know, in some cases, the safe crosswalks were over a mile apart. So they might be 1.7 miles apart. So if you're between those two and you need to get a couple hundred feet across the road, you can either add 3 miles, you know, or a mile or more to your trip to get across the road, or you can make a run for it. And, you know, I think we all wish it weren't the case, but a lot of people are gonna make a run for it if they don't feel that it's, you know, easy for them to get to that crosswalk.
Maren, how has Florida's rapid growth contributed to the problems with US 19 in particular?
Yeah, so Florida has recently, Florida's development, I think, is much more recent than a lot of places, certainly on the East Coast, although I think, you know, it matches the development of much of the South and the Sun Belt. A lot of it was sort of post-World War II buildup, meant to take advantage of the fact that more Americans were driving automobiles. You had tremendous growth during these periods and, you know, real development in a network of highways across the country. And the way that's really manifested is that a lot of these communities were built with the idea that people would be driving and accessing space primarily by cars. So I think that has definitely, you know, contributed to the problem. And I spoke to an expert down there about Florida, and he said, you know, the way to think about Florida is as a leading edge, because we see a lot of growth here happen really quickly relative to the rest of the country. We tend to see a lot of trends happen here nationally quicker than they do in the rest of the country. The flip side of that is that, you know, pedestrian fatalities have been a problem in Florida for quite some time, and they've also been a problem in the U.S. for quite some time. So, like I said before, this is something that started, you know, these pedestrian fatalities started going up over the last 10 years. And then they really shot up during the pandemic. So it's a Florida problem, but in some ways, Florida is representative of the national problem, if that makes sense.
What are the speed limits along most of US 19?
So it's interesting. US 19 actually runs from Erie, Pennsylvania, all the way down to about Clearwater, Florida. And, you know, this didn't make it into the piece, but I think this is maybe an interesting fact for you and your listeners. When I came back from reporting this trip, I was doing some more research on the road, and I realized that this road is actually where I had gotten in a car accident right after I got my license as a 16-year-old driver many years ago. So I'm from Pennsylvania. So it actually starts in Erie, Pennsylvania, and that's where I got in the accident. And it is a strode in my community as well, but it runs the whole length of the country. So in certain places in the country, it's a two-lane slower highway. And in certain places, like in Florida, you know, in Pasco County, it's up to 8 or 9 lanes at many intersections. And the speed limits are 45 to 55 miles an hour. And what the mayor of Newport Richey, who you know, has US 19 running through his town, told me is that, yeah, the speed limit is 45 to 55 miles an hour, but people are often driving 60, 65 miles an hour or more.
Okay, so people treat it like a suggestion rather than a commandment.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think police will try to enforce the speed limit, but there's only so much you can do when the road is designed in a way that sort of encourages people to drive really fast.
Historically, when traffic congestion starts to get intolerable for motorists, the go-to solution has been adding additional lanes for cars and trucks. What do civil engineers now understand about what actually tends to happen once those lanes are built?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I'm not sure that this is, I think there is growing evidence, and there have been multiple studies done on this. I don't know that every Department of Transportation fully understands this yet, but there's this concept called induced demand, which means that if you build more capacity, the number of trips tend to go up. So if you have a road and it ends up being really congested, the typical response from traffic engineers is, let's just add another lane, let's add two more lanes, let's ease up this congestion. But what happens is the increased capacity, the increased number of lanes, actually encourages more trips. So you end up having more people on the road, and you have the situation where you've added lanes to the road and you have the same amount of congestion because more people are taking trips. And so what you end up with are these sort of like Frankenstein roads where just lanes have been added and added and added. And the problem's not getting any better in terms of congestion, but it is getting worse in terms of danger to people outside of the cars.
So in those particular hotspots in Florida along US 19, presumably city and you know, county leaders might want to do something about this, but they're not the ones responsible for building and maintaining the road, right?
That's exactly right. So the mayor of Newport Richey, who has US 19 running through his town, has talked a lot about the ways that it's really difficult to have this giant sort of highway bisecting his community. And for the people who live on the opposite side, it's really difficult because they have to cross that road if they want to go anywhere on the other side of town. They don't make the decisions for arterials like this and US highways in particular. That's all done by the state. So this guy, Charles Marone, who coined the term strode, he says, rather than having traffic engineers and state officials making the decisions about what these roads should look like, it should actually be local elected officials who are reflecting their community's values making the decision. If it were up to Mayor Marlowe, who is the mayor of Newport Richey, he would probably take some lanes off of US 19 and try to slow the traffic way down so people were able to access his community more safely, and so that drivers couldn't just sort of tear through and not, you know, not come into contact with any of the businesses or the people in the town itself.
One thing that always strikes me is the fact that we had a conversation on the show about this a year or so ago. There's no law in America that says you need to own a motor vehicle to get around, but the way that communities are designed and certainly the roads running through them, there are things that people functionally can't access unless they have a vehicle.
Yeah, I think it's really an unfortunate reality. And I think it gets back to that thing that I was talking about the way that our infrastructure in this country is largely built for cars. And it isn't, it's a reality. You need a car in this country, in many places in the United States, certain big cities with highly developed, transportation might not necessarily need it. But in most of the country, you need a car to get around. So it's a problem. I mean, I think, if we had better public transit and more safe places for people to walk and cycle and more safely designed roads, it might not be as much of a problem. But I think, we have a real issue in this country around the way the infrastructure is designed and the way that sort of enforces a culture of driving where we have a hard time imagining it being any different, right? It is different in other parts of the world. We don't necessarily have to do it this way, but our system is currently built this way. And so part of this is just about encouraging people to think, that our pedestrian fatalities are not necessarily normal, and that there are possibly different ways of treating this problem and making sure that it's a safer place for people to walk, bike, but also to drive, because, fatalities for people inside cars have been on the rise as well.
It would seem there's a social component at work in these places where cars often kill pedestrians, right? The idea, at least if you can believe anybody's social media feeds, many drivers have that this idea that only cars ought to be on the road, that pedestrians don't belong on roads, that cyclists don't belong on roads. Are there things about the way we've developed roads in this country that have fed that perception?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you really hit the nail on the head. I mean, a lot of it is just that because we're so dependent on cars in this country, we tend to think, and because we design the roads for cars in this country, we really sort of inculcate drivers, and I count myself among them, right? This is certainly not to blame drivers because I'm a driver, but we tend to think that cars are the only thing that should be on the roads, right? And it's because they're built to tell us that. The cues are all telling us, this was designed for me to get to where I'm going as safely and quickly as possible. And to the extent that there are slower people, pedestrians, vehicles, whatever on the road, they're in my way. And I do think that's a problem. I think that if we had a society that encouraged people and had street design, maybe more importantly, that encouraged people to share the road a little bit more and to realize that everyone has the right to use the road, and that we all have the right to walk, to bike, and to drive, and to feel safe in this country, then I think we might be able to get somewhere a little bit more easily than we do now. I think right now it unfortunately falls into these divides of pedestrians versus car drivers. And it's always struck me as strange because most of us do both things, I think, right?
Yeah. Well, another social factor in this is the way accidents are scrutinized after the fact. What are investigators focusing on when they look into a pedestrian killed by a motorist?
Yeah, so it's not just investigators, although it is investigators. This is also a cultural thing, I think, and we all have this instinct to, when we hear about an accident, to try to comfort ourselves by saying that this could never happen to us. And the author Jesse Singer, who wrote this book called There Are No Accidents, has touched upon this in a really smart way. So oftentimes when a pedestrian is killed, we'll say something like, why were they walking at night? What were they wearing? Could they be seen clearly? Were they in a crosswalk? Were they texting? And we do this because we kind of want to reassure ourselves that this would never happen to us and that we could never do this. The alternate thing to consider, which is the reality, is that we have all been in these situations, both as pedestrians and as drivers, that weren't safe and could have led to a catastrophic outcome. So I think there is a lot of, it's almost victim blaming when someone is killed who's a pedestrian, but or a cyclist, or even drivers. Were they texting? Were they drinking? And I do think, this is not to say that individual behavior isn't important, because it is, but the almost exclusive focus is on, don't text and drive, don't drink, all of these things that sort of put the blame on individuals. We clearly have a systemic issue and a systemic problem, and it would be great to start addressing the systemic issues rather than asking everyone to constantly be doing better when we know that that strategy has not worked.
Right. So focusing on individual behavior allows us to completely overlook systems that don't work well, that facilitate accidents, as it were.
That's exactly it. It's exactly it. We focus on the individual behavior because it allows us to not see the broader picture that's going on. And that's a big part of why I wanted to do this piece. There is a measurable evidence-based rise in pedestrian fatalities in this country that is really concerning, that has really shot up in the last few years. And it would be nice if we could just tell everyone to, you know, be safer and make better personal choices. And of course, those are important things to do. But we actually have a design issue here going on. And so once we start addressing the design problems, we can make the streets a lot safer and understand that people will make mistakes. But with safer designs, we can save more lives.
Okay, I want to go to the phones now, starting with Carol calling us from Tyler, Texas. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Good afternoon. I was interested in finding out what if there will be a focus on the statistics or hit and run, failure to stop and render aid when there is no accountability because the person leaves the scene, and wonder how all that factor into your work, because it's increasing, but you don't hear a lot about it. But people, they leave, and if they can, you know, hide the vehicle or stay away from law enforcement, then basically they can get away with testing or any kind of questioning. And I'm very interested in that area and would love to see on that. Do you
have- Carol, thanks for your call. What do you know about that, Maren?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, Carol. It is something that there isn't great data that I have seen on that specific issue, but I will say while reporting this story in Florida, multiple of the families of victims I spoke to were situations where it was a hit and run. And they described, I mean, just the horror, first of all, of having their loved one left there to die essentially on the side of the road while someone drove away. But also in some cases, people going to great lengths to destroy the vehicle so that they wouldn't be caught. It's a really difficult issue. And I think, you know, part of it is that when people feel like laws aren't being enforced, they often feel like they can leave a scene of a crime and, you know, try to get away with it. And it's something that I think traffic cameras would go a long way towards solving. You know, one of the reasons I think that Europe has much lower fatality rates than we do is that there are traffic cameras almost everywhere, and they are taking photos of people who are driving really recklessly. And so you don't have the same level of hit and runs because you couldn't do it in many of these places. And I think we could potentially have something like that here. So again, I don't know the specific numbers. I don't know if any of these organizations are tracking hit and runs in general, but certainly my reporting seems to suggest that that's on the rise. And it really, I think, compounds the trauma that family members feel when they lose a loved one in this way, to know that someone didn't even stop, that they kept driving. And the family that I wrote about in this story was one of those cases where the driver left the scene and he was ultimately arrested. But I think the fact that he left was one of the most traumatic parts of it to them.
All right. Next on the phone, let's speak with Lane in Garland, Texas. Hi, Lane.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the subject. I'm just curious, unless I've missed it since the beginning of the program, I keep hearing the term, the word design, design, design. We have design issues. Can you tell me about the term, talk about the term complete streets in an urban or suburban environment where, say, for example, you have along the side of the street and the buildings, you have storefronts, then you have the sidewalk, then you have planters or trees, then you have the curb, then you have bicycle lane, and then you finally get to the street lanes. Can you tell me about kind of the general progress that states or cities are making in those design efforts?
Well, thank you so much for your call, Lane.
Yeah, I think that's I think complete streets is a great point that you bring up, and it's a key component, I think, in the efforts to make streets safer. So I think Lane did a really good job describing complete streets, but just to sort of reiterate and recap. So a complete street is the notion that we're designing streets not just for cars, like we talked about. We're designing them to accommodate people outside of vehicles as well, pedestrians, cyclists, We're designing them to make sure that people are able to access the businesses on the sides of the roads. And so there is, it's not a one size fits all sort of solution. It's about looking at a specific street and deciding what it needs. In some places that might be protected bike lanes, and some places it might be actually changing the shape of the road, adding islands, adding barriers so that cars aren't just sort of able to fly straight through. It's a little bit slower so that cars are forced to slow down a little bit. And so people are able to access sidewalks, access bike lanes, and access the space in a way that makes sense for more users than just drivers. So this has been a key component in trying to make streets safer. It's underway in numerous cities and communities across the country. The federal government is investing more money in those efforts as we speak. And I think what is really promising about Complete Streets is the idea that you are designing something that makes sense for that community and that space. It's still somewhat piecemeal. We need a lot more of it all across the country, and we need it in communities. Like you said, we need it in communities that are low income and tend to have less access to resources, because what we've seen about these deadly hotspots in the study is that 75% of them are bordered by low income communities. So it is an important effort. I hope it continues. It needs to happen in many places, not just in cities.
Folks who are unhoused are at perhaps the greatest risk of being killed by an automobile when they're on foot. How serious is the problem of those accidents being sort of written off, even by investigators?
Yeah, it's really serious. You know, certainly I think that was a big issue in Pasco County, you know, especially as lower income residents were forced out to the suburbs. And then I think particularly after the financial crisis in 2008, and then particularly with the pandemic, there was a much higher number of people experiencing homelessness in that community. And there are many studies that show that people who are houseless are much more vulnerable to being struck by a car. And, you know, certainly people who don't have a home tend to not have as much political power, you know, as, for example, the automobile industry. So they are sometimes written off, I think, by investigators. And it is really important to, I think, especially for people who work with people who are homeless and who love them and are connected to them, to, you know, advocate for their personhood. That was something when I spoke to some families, they said, you know, my loved one was written off as homeless. He had a whole family that loved him. You know, it doesn't change that fact. His life was still very important, and he deserved to be able to access spaces safely.
We know that people who get around mostly by driving tend to complain when there's a lot of traffic congestion. They have political power because presumably they have more money than people who are left most vulnerable to this. What are local communities doing to build support for something, you know, as antithetical to the American way as broadly slowing down traffic in busy urban areas?
You know, that's a great question. And if anyone who's listening knows a community who's doing a great job at this, let me know, because I haven't found great examples of that. I just think that, you know, and again, I find this all ironic because most of us both drive and walk. So most of us are both, but oftentimes, and I think particularly online, there tends to be this sort of breakdown, this sort of internecine conflict between people who drive and people who bike or walk. And there's this real sense of, you know, people who are not inside cars or in my way. And I don't want to, you know, completely put this on drivers, because certainly I have been a frustrated driver stuck in traffic. But I think what's been really helpful for me as a driver is understanding, you know, that we do have this problem in our country. And, you know, something I've experienced as well as a runner and a biker. And you know, learning that, one, to make things safer, we're going to all have to slow down and learn to share the road a little bit more. And two, that it's actually not just about our personal behaviors, that we can feel our sense of personal frustration, but understand that it's in part because we have roads that are dangerous by design.
All right, back to the phones now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Mark is calling us from McKinney, Texas. Hi, Mark.
Hey, I have a question for you. You know, 10 years ago, I'm a runner, and I run an hour every day. And 10 years ago, there's police, and there was sidewalks, and we didn't have this problem. And now the police are gone, and people are driving really erratic. And I've been almost hit several times. And you're kind of forced on the street because there's no sidewalks. And the drivers are very angry that you're on the street.
Yeah. Thanks for your
call.
Yeah,
I'm sorry that happened, Mark. And it's something I'm nodding my head over here because it's happened to me too. You know, I've crossed the street as a runner, and I really became a runner in the pandemic. And I do think that, and a cyclist as well. And I think it's part of what helped me notice. It does seem to me, I don't have strong evidence on this, and I know a lot of the safety advocates, urge caution with this notion that there's something going on with drivers and that we've lost a little bit of patience. But I would say my anecdata, which is not actual data, but just sort of anecdotes and observations, does seem to me to suggest that, you know, there's not as much patience with people who are using the road to run or to bike. So I don't know how we get that sense of sort of community fabric back in, where we all look out for each other a little more and don't see each other as nuisances. But it's something I've experienced, and hopefully raising awareness about the increase in deaths can cause us all to hit pause for a moment and think about this a little bit more.
All right, next on the phone to Kayla in Dallas. Hi, Kayla.
Hi. I was wondering if you had any insight as to why city planners don't look to the past when it comes to city planning. If you look at Dallas's own M streets or even downtown, the streets are tightly compacted and more rectangular, and they're a lot more walkable. And that's because things actually used to be walkable, but now suburbs are all walkable for parks, and we're walking to your neighbor's home, but not for walking to, like, say, the store. It requires you to get in a car. And when things are more accessible just by walking, it makes the entire environment, not just for animals, but for people, that much better. Is there a reason we're not doing that?
Thanks for calling.
That is a great question. I think that I could probably write a whole article answering that question. I do think a lot of it is just about, on some level, we're going through a cultural change, I think, and we're starting to realize the importance of walkable spaces. And I do think, you know, one thing that's positive is that there's more of an infrastructure being built up now of people advocating for the types of things you're talking about, so that hopefully future designs will be more approachable for people to be able to live their entire lives in ways that are friendly to pedestrians and not just, you know, I have to get in the car every time I want to go somewhere. But I think that change has been slow to come. And I think it's, you know, particularly with the spaces that are already going to be built, it's going to take some time. I also just realized I didn't fully address Mark's question. And I want to just say really quickly, I've noticed in my own community that it seems like there's very little enforcement. And I do wonder here if that encourages people. On some level, it makes sense to not obey speed limits and traffic signs if you know that there's not going to be any consequences for it. And I do think, you know, there may be some hesitance to enforce traffic stops because they've been unsafe for certain drivers and drivers of color in particular in the past. But there are other things we could do, like automated enforcement, that would help address that problem.
Okay, next on the phone to Court in Coppell, Texas. Hi, Court.
Good day. Real briefly, I spent some time in Kansas this past couple weeks and near Hayes, and they had just implemented some roundabouts. I wanted to see if the guests the guests could just go over kind of the pros and cons of roundabouts with respect to safety, cost, maintenance, that sort of thing.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, great question. So traffic circles are definitely one of the tools in traffic designers' arsenals to make roads safer for drivers and pedestrians. They work by slowing drivers down and also just forcing them to pay a little bit more attention to what they're doing. I think in terms of safety, they can make the roads safer for drivers, cyclists, and pedestrians. Although I will say I've also heard of examples in my own communities of cyclists, you know, being killed in traffic circles. They are expensive, but they are, I think, very popular strategies in many communities that I've looked into in terms of getting the traffic to slow down a little bit and forcing drivers to pay attention. And they have been pretty effective in DC. I know, I think they were initially designed to help if there were, this was, you know, hundreds of years ago, but they were designed to help sort of slow down traffic coming into and out of the city. But they have proven pretty effective in that regard.
You bringing up D.C., Maren, makes me think about the way that probably in part due to statutes, but cities have distinctly different cultures when it comes to car versus pedestrian exchanges. When I travel to D.C., I'm always amazed that as a walker, I can assume I have the right of way when a light changes for my direction to be green. Walking around in North Texas, I can't assume that cars will let me go first before they make their right turn or whatever.
Yeah, it's super interesting to compare our experiences because, you know, I will say on some level, DC is a super friendly place to walk and bike, and there's good infrastructure. And part of that is that it's a small, dense place, right? The flip side of that is that DC had the highest jump in its fatality rate for pedestrians in the country in 2020. So, I mean, part of that is an issue of numbers and population. We have a pretty tiny population compared to a lot of places, Texas included. But, you know, I do think that a lot of it is you have a lot of people packed into a very tight space. There are just naturally going to be a lot of people commuting by foot or by bike. And the fact that there is such a large constituency of those people creates a sort of political constituency to design streets that are safer.
Has reporting on this changed the way you behave when you're going somewhere on foot?
Great question. It's definitely changed the way I drive. I am definitely much more aware. I'm much more patient. The one thing that I think of all the time is, you know, I think many of us have done the thing where we pause and come to almost a complete stop at a stop sign, but don't necessarily fully brake the car and stop the car, hard stop. It's completely changed that for me. I always make sure I do that. In terms of being a pedestrian, I don't know. I mean, I've always tried to, you know, operate in crosswalks and make sure that I'm visible to drivers before I go. But I think it's just made me think so much more about the way I move around in the world. And I think a lot of us experienced that during the pandemic. A lot of us were getting around differently during that time. And I hope that this moment of change, I mean, we've had so many big disruptions to our lives. It's easy to ignore something like how we get around, but it's also so fundamental to the way we live. And there is such an opportunity for improvement here. It has for me, and I hope it does, you know, help other people think about the way they get around.
This is a little bit out of left field, so if you don't know, I'm sorry for putting you on the spot, but do you know if federal transportation dollars given to states and communities, can that money ever pay for things like sidewalks?
Oh, great question. Yes. So I believe that it can, although I'm speaking primarily of the $5 billion that the Department of Transportation just announced was going to cities and communities and states to build safer streets. So I would double check that, but I know in that case that some of that money is going specifically to making things safer for pedestrians. But it gets really hard to talk about this on a granular level because everything is going to be, on a big picture level, because everything's going to be decided on a state, community, and local level. So it'll probably look different depending on what each community needs.
And are traffic planners thinking more carefully about the potential for fatalities on the part of pedestrians now than they were before these numbers started going up?
I think so. I mean, I don't want to speak for a profession, and there are people who are real experts at this who have been doing this for a long time, but they're certainly aware of the criticism. And, you know, this man I spoke about, Charles Marone, who came up with the term strode, he has been a really prominent critic of the way that roads are designed. There's also Dangerous by Design, the semi-annual report by I think Transportation for America, which has encouraged people to start thinking more carefully about design and how to make streets safer. So it's certainly true that there are a lot of people thinking about this. And, you know, for the people who have worked in this space, I have not presented them with anything new. It's stuff that they're already thinking about and thinking about how to improve.
Maren Kogan is a senior correspondent at Vox, where you can find her article, The Deadliest Road in America. Maren, it's been really interesting. Thanks for making time to talk with us.
Thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
We're on Twitter at KERA Think, and we hope you'll subscribe to our podcast by searching for KERA Think wherever you get your podcasts, or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.